Welcome to Endless 08, a time loop anime podcast. I'm BJ.
And I'm Duffo.
It is 2008. We are watching and discussing anime from 2008, the year that it is.
And what a beautiful year it is.
Beautiful. Ooh, new way to describe it. I like it.
We
I like
are
it.
Branching out. You'll remember last time we started off our A Certain Magical Index episode, which we're returning to in part two. We started it off by talking about Funimation a bit.
Yes.
We were talking about their acquisition of Dragon Ball.
Yep.
Whether or not you can show a child pissing on television.
Yep.
And there is more to this story.
Okay.
That I did want to get into.
Please.
I was reading here. There are a lot of very flattering profiles of Gen Fukunaga, as you might imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
I was reading through this Forbes one here. The man who brought anime to America. Sony Pictures Television's Funimation CEO, Gen Fukunaga.
That is a long series of titles.
that tense problem is in the title.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, 100%. It's just that's a lot.
So he's talking about, like, you know, kind of his own experiences being at the top of this company, founding it for the first time, saying he was previously working for Tandem Computers, which is a tech startup.
Yeah,
which shat itself.
Yeah, I've heard of Tandem Computers before. I don't know how, but I've definitely heard of it.
Yeah. He says here, quote, "I didn't think Tandem was going to make it, which turned out to be true. And I thought, I'm either going to go to a startup or start my own company. I initially assumed it would be in a high-tech business, but I just kept remembering my anime experience, as there still wasn't anime in America. So I started Funimation in 1994 to change that. Fortunately, my uncle was a well-known producer in Japan, not in anime, but in live-action side.
Oh.
He had actually directed and produced shows like Power Rangers in Japan," said Fukunaga.
Right.
So when we're talking about it, there was a Toei guy that his connection was.
Yes.
It's actually a Power Rangers guy on the live action side.
Right.
"Well, his uncle made the right connections for him. Fukunaga pursued seed capital to purchase the rights of the most successful title coming out of Japan at that time, Dragon Ball Z. Quote, I was really fortunate there because a family friend of mine, Daniel Kokunoga, had just made a bunch of money investing in a video game, and Dragon Ball was a very popular game as well outside the US, said Fukunaga. They took a chance on another game investment. So that's how they got the initial $2 million, is actually they were trying to popularize Dragon Ball so that they could sell the Dragon Ball, like, video games.
Right.
And fighting games.
I'm trying to think back, and I don't actually remember any Dragon Ball fighting games being big at that time. So, wow.
Yes, it's something like, you know, it was in, you know, France and Spain.
Right.
I imagine like the South American audience would have gotten, like, very into the
fighting games.
Says, yeah, we started with $2 million total seed capital and got the title, and that's how the whole company started, and we literally never took another penny in debt or equity after that initial investment.
Wow. Oh, my God.
From there, it jumped straight to 2005 and selling the whole thing for $120 million. So it paints a very flattering portfolio that not necessarily how that story would be told if it weren't the CEO telling that story.
Absolutely, absolutely. But even that, like, the fact that they didn't go back into debt at all, quite amazing.
So.
Oh.
The initial purchase that they made and that they kicked off on was not Dragon Ball Z, it was Dragon Ball.
Right.
As discussed and reported by Texas Fort Worth outlet, whatever that was.
Yep.
It aired for 13 episodes and got canned.
Oh. Right. Okay.
And it was actually, they had to have another crack at it. They came back. They got Dragon Ball Z this time.
Right.
And that was the one where they started airing it. Cartoon Network picked it up. It started getting all these top ratings and stuff like that. I said they were working with Saban, who was the company up in Vancouver, who was helping them out with all the production stuff. They were hiring all the voice actors and stuff. But they were up for a renewal of this show. The renewal was going to require a lot of production money that, like, the Saban couldn't continue offering them out of the partnership.
Right.
So what Funimation was actually doing at the time is, like, we will just let reruns go for a bit. We will let the money from that back up. And then we're going to solo it.
Oh.
Now, the reason this is looked back on as, like, quite a controversial move is that they couldn't use the Vancouver voice cast, obviously.
Yes.
Because that wasn't attached to them.
Yep.
So instead, they found a bunch of local, sometimes complete amateurs in Texas.
No.
And had them doing their best impressions
oh,
of the voices
God.
Of the Vancouver cast.
Oh, my God. Wow. Dang. All right. Not as rosy a story. Wow.
So, I mean, look, they weren't taking extra seed capital money then.
Yeah, they were just fucking over the guys in Vancouver. All of them, collectively. Oh, my God.
Yes. Yeah, you'll find, like, you know, hardcore Dragon Ball fans will actually talk about the different dubs here. And especially because after they continued making this show, they went back and redubbed the original episodes that they'd made with the new cast.
Ooh. Yikes. How does voice acting work with royalties and such? Because if they've gone back, and like, if they get any at all, I'm assuming they don't, probably, given how production stuff goes and how royalties don't tend to work out for people who probably deserve them.
Yeah. I can't speak to it at the time whether it was a lump sum or whether they were getting residuals, but certainly in terms of a lot of voice actors have appearances going forward. You know, if you voiced Goku or Vegeta, you get regular booking at anime cons and stuff like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, exactly.
You get that sitting on your resume or whatever.
So these guys probably from Vancouver were like, I voiced Goku.
And they're like, no, at you one point fucking did
for a bit.
I know who the voice of Goku is. That's not you.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Mm.
Any opinions on the internet about which dub is better?
Yes, and that's a whole other episode's worth of stuff we can't fucking get into. There are many Dragon Ball focused podcasts that will talk about this.
Okay.
We are not a Dragon Ball podcast. We are a 2008. A certain magical index going from episode 15 through to the end.
Yes. Yeah, it's been another fun ride. Not as fun as the initial arcs, but you know, there was some stuff in here that was fun and nice.
We lose steam a little bit.
We do.
The section we are talking about, this pretty much picks up at the start of the Angel Fall arc.
Yep.
And it goes through to the Sherry Cromwell stuff.
Yes.
And ends off with there. That's where season one caps off.
Yeah, it's an interesting place to end because we don't have much of an indication of what's coming next. I wonder if that might have just been because they were a bit cagey about, you know, we don't know if we're going to have more coming. So
yeah, they wanted this thing renewed so bad. That's sometimes viewed as like a modern problem with shows, especially like the Netflix produced series.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where they will put a bunch of teasers at the end of a season, hoping that it'll get renewed, and then it just gets canned after two seasons anyway.
Yep.
But yes. Even the last like 3 minutes of the last episode of this show is introducing a bunch of stuff that doesn't make any sense to you.
Yeah, 100%. Like, we've got Accelerator back, which is great. I talk about Accelerator, but I like him as a character. I think he's really, like, interesting.
Yeah.
What else happened? I forgot.
There's a blonde British lady, and she has plans.
Oh, yeah. The blonde British lady shows up, and she's got plans, and that's it. That's all we know. There was the conversation about, again, like, getting kind of Evangelion-ish, and there's a sinister plan.
With
that's
the imaginary number school district. The
fucking name. Yeah, and just the idea that they're trying to make an angel or something and make
atheist heaven.
Just wild, absolutely wild, and completely unexplained. Like they give an explanation of what is happening, but no, like, why of any of this. What a weird way to end. But yeah, so we start this arc, this series of arcs, with the Angel Fall arc.
Yeah, you were talking about this last episode already. Because yes, you were saying this is the reason that the memory loss stuff worked for you.
Yes.
I get it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Now that I've seen it, you need to set up a premise where it is plausible that he would not recognize what his own parents look like.
Exactly, exactly. In this arc, effectively, the Academy City like higher-ups have said, Toma, you're collecting too much attention. You're making it difficult for us. You're fucking up all our plans. So you know what? Piss off to a beach island for a couple of days and just get out of here. We don't want you here for the moment. And so he goes off to visit his family on this beach island. And as you said, in the last arc, how many arcs ago it was, he lost his memory completely. I think they mentioned that it was it wasn't that he'd lost the memory, but that it was the memory had been obliterated, which, oh, beautiful. I love Frog Doctor. And so they...
Who gets some lore behind him?
I got a note. His name is... Where is it?
Is it Heaven Canceller?
Heaven Canceller. That was it. What a cool name for a dumb dude. It's so silly. Oh, so much fun. So he takes Index to the beach to go and meet the family. And when the family arrives, this is where Toma starts to realize that everyone's bodies have been swapped.
Yes.
In a very weird way.
Yeah, this is introduced because his family shows up and his young cousin looks like Misaka.
Yeah.
His dad looks like just some dude.
Some middle-aged man.
His mum looks like Index.
Index, which, oof, yeah, we'll get into that. but then also we've got the fact that all the characters in this are swapped. At one point he sees he goes into the hotel and he sees a TV going and the teacher has become the US president. And
No, that was Shiori.
That's right.
Wait, is that her name? Shirai.
Shirai, yes.
Shirai is the... She's Obama.
She's Obama. It's fantastic. And it was the teacher has become the news.
The news reporter, yeah.
News reporter. And so all these people have swapped. And then it turns out that in the hotel, there were two hotel workers that are helping out. One of them is Stale Magnus, and the other one is one of the Misaka sisters. And things transpire. We end up having Sword Lady back, whose name I can't remember.
Kanzaki shows up.
Kanzaki shows back up. And Toma's friend.
Yeah, Tsushi Mikado.
Ah, Tsushi Mikado, yep. So Kanzaki shows up, and Tsushi Mikado shows up.
His friend from high school who's been unnamed at this point. He's just kind of hung around and been like a very bro-y kind of dude so far.
Yeah, it turns out he's a spy for either the Puritan Church or for Academy City. He just leaves it as, I'm working for me, baby. I'm just doing all the spy stuff.
Yeah, he is a feng shui mage who went into Academy City, went through the process of becoming an Esper, except what just happened is it crapped out both sides. So he's now like a level zero Esper who can't do shit, but also his magic physically hurts him to do.
Yeah.
And he does a bunch of vomiting if he has to do it.
Bursts his blood vessels and stuff. Oh, great stuff. But they both show up and turns out that, you know, this whatever this spell is, turns out it's called Angel Falls. Angel's Fall?
Angel Fall, yeah.
Angel Fall. And it's affecting the whole world. So it's not just the people he knows, it's everyone all over the world has been swapped around. And we see this a couple of times when they go into the city at one point. We see just some random people walking by and it's like a really big buff dude wearing like a schoolgirl's like outfit, and then, you know, some young schoolgirls wearing like an old person outfit with a cane or whatever. Things like that. And there's another character that appears who is part of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yes, that's how she introduces herself, Misha.
Misha, that was the name.
It's this tiny girl who wears a very strange bondage outfit with, like, hammers and shit strapped to her.
Yeah,
and
very weird.
Her vocal quirk is that she always starts her sentences with, like, question number one or opinion number one, and, like, numbers everything she wants to talk about.
Yeah. Was that as annoying as the Misaka sisters' vocal tick?
I think... It definitely comes off as very weird, but there is payoff to it at the end, I think.
Okay.
Because the twist here is that this angel fall is a ritual that has been done to drag an angel down out of heaven so that a mortal can climb up into heaven. And the twist here is that, you know, the Misha is like a fake identity that has been assumed by the angel that's been dragged out of heaven. And it's like, of course she fucking talks weird. She's an angel.
Yeah, okay, yeah, absolutely.
But I guess everyone is so used to weird talking magicians that no one questions it.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I should also note that we've got the body swapping happening, and part of the reason why we're just kind of running along with the fact that this person is who they say they are is because I don't know who the fuck that is. None of the other mages know who the fuck that is. They're just like, yeah, okay, cool, makes sense. You don't appear to have any, you know, angel fall stuff related to you at the moment when they meet them. So like, yeah, okay, cool. But the fun part is that Tsushi Mikado apparently looks to everyone else like the famous actor.
Like a boy band member.
Yeah,
or something,
random famous boy band actor. And so he's just like trying to lay low. And that Kanzaki is somehow looking like Steel Magnus.
Yeah, which is strange because there was also another dude in the
inn. Because there's the guy in the inn who is also looking like Steel Magnus. I'm like, what? What is that? Okay, we're just going to move on with it. We should also point out that Toma can see that all of these people have the wrong bodies because he is not affected by the magic because of his right hand.
Yeah, it's a bit inconsistently applied because you can see Kanzuki and Tsuchi Mikado.
Well, they said that they put barriers up to protect themselves, but it didn't fully stop the effects of the spell.
Because they're mages, and you're right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, they sensed it and they put something up, but it didn't fully stop it. They were like, oh, yeah, it's slightly too late. Yep. Whereas Toma's just completely unaffected. He's just like, what's going on? This is so weird.
But can't dispel it from other people.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Very interesting.
They say this ritual must have been done from a ritual site. So you got to shut down the site if you want to shut down the spell.
Yeah. So the whole point of this one is that we've got the two kind of main ideas, which is we need to find out who's doing Angel Fall. It's apparently centered nearby wherever Toma is for some reason. But we need to figure that out and stop it. And we also need Toma to figure out what his family is like and just deal with a weird family who all look like his friends. Course, we're at a beach resort, so we get some fun beach episode.
The show in the second half really wants to up the amount of fan service of Index that you were getting.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah, I do not love looking at a 14-year-old girl's ass.
No.
I do not love that what they do here, of course, because his mum looks like that. And so they're playing it off like, oh, you know, Index would never wear a skimpy bikini, but, you know, his mum would.
Yeah. So it's basically just an excuse to put her in a skimpy bikini.
Yes.
Not good. You know what is fun, though? We didn't mention that Index has also switched bodies. She looks like Toma's other friend, whose name I don't know, who's a guy.
Yes.
A big guy.
The blue head guy, yeah.
And he walks out in a one piece and I was like, oh, okay. They actually showed that. Okay, fun, cool. I liked that. It was fun. Not appealing in any way, but it was fun.
Yeah. What this all ends up coming around on, the ritual has been performed by his dad, who we discover because they find photos of the guy and they're like, oh, he didn't change at all, which means he's also a mage who was protecting himself.
Yeah.
No, he's not a mage. He did it by accident. He has spent the last several years collecting good luck charms for his son, who is perpetually unlucky.
I love this so much. I love this idea that dad cares so much and has gone, well, you know what? Like, he goes through his, like, when Toma confronts him about this, he goes through the spiel of like, well, I saw that you, like, everyone said you were bad luck and it was like really not a nice thing to have happen to you. So I put you into Academy City where I was really hoping that, you know, it's the science city.
Yeah, no one's bad superstitious.
Luck, nobody's superstitious. Bad luck isn't a thing. I put you in there. And yet somehow they still said you were bad luck. Like there was a bit of like, yeah, what's going on here? Weird, let's research it. But then eventually they just gave up and went, no, this kid's just bad luck. And that really disheartened dad. And so he thought, all right, what else can I do? I travel a lot for business. I will go and get as many lucky charms as I can. And it's a really nice motivation.
It is, yeah.
And then I love Toma's response, which is, get fucked. You think my life sucks? No, my life is great. I got bad luck, but have I let that stop me? Does this look like a face of giving a fuck about that? No.
Yeah, look, I was easily sold on all of the motivations going through here. I like that, you know, all of it got placed in their new house by accident, and it's just because there were thousands of good luck charms that had accidentally created a ritual that ripped an angel out of heaven.
Like, specifically, I love the fact that we've got Tsuchi Mikado as the one who goes with Toma to the house to find out what's going on, because they're looking around and like, oh, well, there's a lot of weird artifacts around. And Tsuchi Mikado is immediately like, oh, shit.
All his feng shui senses are going off.
And that's the thing. He's a feng shui mage. He's here like, oh, that's a... And at one point he mentions the tigers and he's like, the tigers are facing east or something like that. And he's like, oh, doesn't tell us anything. But Toma goes to move something and he's like, get your fucking hand away. Don't touch that. We find out later that if something had been moved due to the feng shui nature of everything, could have fucked things up even worse. The spell could have even like transformed and become like destroy all people spell or something. So, wow, interesting stuff. I love that they solved this by blowing up the house.
I like that.
We can't move anything. We should blow up the whole house all at once. Problem fixed.
Yes, but he's... This annoyed me a little at the end, where he doesn't explain to them that he's going to blow up the house.
No.
Instead, he makes it seem like he's going to murder Toma and his dad.
Exactly. That was just unnecessary, for sure. For sure.
I mean, you get a nice fist fight scene where it's again shown Toma does not have any decent kind of martial ability.
We're going to skip ahead a little bit. My favorite part of this whole thing is that Toma isn't any good at anything, really. And so his big move is just big punch. We end the series with the big bad, with Toma doing a big punch. Twice.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
There is nothing else. He just does big punch. Oh, it's beautiful. We do also in this, like, the angel, we find out that Misha is the angel, and so in order to buy time for Toma and Shimikara to go and break the spell or find the spell, Kanzaki ends up fighting the angel. And the explanation of magic in this show is just so nonsensical.
This is heavily researched.
Yeah, it's just so, like...
Supposedly.
Like, in this, we find out that there's actually something special about Kanzaki. She's not just a normal mage. She is, like, an avatar for some kind of, not god, but maybe in, like, some kind of spirit of some kind, of a smaller Japanese sect that exists in Japan within the greater Christian ecclesiarchy or whatever, but... Like, yeah. It's a really small, weird one.
She's from a denomination from a time where you couldn't be openly Christian in Japan, so they hid it underneath their Shinto beliefs.
Yeah, and because of this, yep. We go through all of that explanation, we find out that the fact that she is a part of this special Japanese sect that has the Shinto beliefs and all of that, it means that normal Christians can't kill an angel because there's rules saying you can't kill an angel. But because she's part of the special sect of Hiramis, that she can kill an angel. And I'm like,
yeah, she's polytheistic.
Yeah, like, did we really need to go through all of that? Like, let's just have these people, like, even just say, like, you know, I know that I can't kill you, but I'm going to try my best to just, like, hold you back.
Yeah, absolutely. Even and there's no reason to go into depth there because she doesn't kill the angel.
Then, like, the whole, like, Toma's dad accidentally did it because he not only had all of the religious things, but they also ended up aligning with the feng shui principles in the house. Like, it's just so detailed, but I'm not going to bother to research if anything's actually right, so I'm just going to trust it. But even then, it's just too detailed. We don't need all this, really. We can just skip through some of it.
I thought that was fun because there's a turtle plush in the bathroom and it's like, that turtle plush represents the water god of the north.
That was a fun one. I'm not going to comment too much about that one. But yeah, like, there's so many moments when it's just so, goes into so much detail. We really just don't need that much detail. Mm. We can just say, let's fight.
Yeah. Speaking of taking elements from mythology and lore, we do move into some Aztec stuff. In the next, like, this, it's not even an arc. It is a single episode.
It's a single episode. This dude, Unabara.
Unabara, yeah.
He shows up and he's been, harassing is the wrong word, but he's been getting on the nerves of Misaka, showing up to her every single day. Just going like, hey, yeah. Cool. So let's hang out. Let's go do this thing. Yeah.
Obviously, he has a crush on her, but is, like, very awkward about it. But also, he's the grandson of the director of Academy City or something, so she doesn't feel like she can rebut him.
Yeah, and so she's just trying to figure out, how can I get out of this without getting into any trouble? And of course, Toma, with his bad luck, shows up right then, and she spear tackles him and says, please go along with this, I just want to get out of here. Toma, far too chill, just going along with shit. Just way too chill. This girl spear tackles him and goes, please just go with me, and he's like, okay.
Well,
go on a date? Okay.
In his defense, any time that something like this has happened in the past, it has been a very big, serious problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does turn out to be a big, serious problem.
Yeah, it's...
If there's one thing he can trust, if that is his luck is shit enough, that if someone like, you know, tackles him on the street and says, please go with this, he's going to go, oh, well, fuck, there's a sorcerer.
Yeah. Which... shouldn't be the case in this case, but it is somehow. So they go on a date, on a fake date. They talk about stuff, and she mentions that Unabara has been hanging around, he's being really annoying, and she doesn't want to deal with it. And turns out Tomba's got a bunch of summer holidays homework that he hasn't done, so she starts helping him with it. And then as thanks for joining him on for joining her on the date, she goes off to buy him some food, and then Unabara shows up again to Tomba and goes, "Oh, hey, do you like her?" He's like, "So what if I do?" And Unabara, you know, trying to pry a bit, trying to, you know, he wants to be with her, it seems. He tries to
butts in on the homework too. It was strange to me, like, how simple all of the answers were for the homework. Because anytime they help, they're like, "Oh, the answer to that's 4.
I like the fact that they're not even helping with it. They're just giving him the answer. It's never like, "Oh, no, do you know how this one works? Okay, this is the equation you got to." It's just, it's number 4 and number 6.
Yeah, that's not even getting into the equations.
Not at
which
all.
Which kind of makes me wonder how far behind he is with. Because I have been thinking about this, the role that, like, level zeros play.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, like, you know, are they still trying to get powers out of them? Because you mentioned that the teacher's, like, really pushing them very hard. The only thing that makes sense for me for the level zeros is that they've got to be a control group in the city. Like, we are doing all of this Esper training on people, and we need people who it doesn't work on because we can glean relevant data from that.
Okay, okay.
Except, I guess, none of them look hard enough at it to glean the relevant data, like, "Oh, this guy has a Magin Breaker."
Yeah.
Or, "Oh, this guy is secretly a wizard."
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, but I think that relies on the presupposition that they are at the school to enhance their Esper powers.
Well, that's what Academy City is for.
That's what Academy City is for, but is that what the schools are for? Because if that's so, why is Accelerator not at a school? Why is he not going to school regularly and doing that? They set up this whole other, like, thing, program thing over here for him to become a level 6.
Yeah, I guess the argument there is he's a level 5. I mean, Mizuka still goes to school, but he is someone who they're like, "We're not going to get further progress out of you by teaching you regular stuff. We've got to go straight to the murdering."
Yeah, yeah. And I just, how are they sure that we are going to potentially get something out of these level zeros by continuing to hammer them with schoolwork? Like, what indication do they have that, you know, there are people who just don't have a talent for a thing?
Oh yeah, and that's my thoughts. That's why I see them as more of a control group, because they're saying, "We're never going to be able to teach these kids anything, but we should keep giving them the program anyway, just to make sure that the program we are giving things is the thing that's helping the Espers we are working with."
Yeah, okay. And I guess then we could consider that a reflection of, you know, the education system in Japan, I guess. The fact that, you know, it is very clear, apparently, to these people that if they are the control group, it is very clear to them that they will not achieve on these tests or anything like that. But we're not going to adjust things so that we can allow them to not achieve and let them continue on with whatever and, you know, still have them undertake these extra things over here, but, like, you know, teach them other things they might need to know in life, like doing taxes and things like that. We're just going to keep hammering them with the hard stuff that we know for a fact that they cannot even, like, start to complete, let alone fully complete. And that feels somewhat in line with, you know, industrialized education systems. You know, we've got standardized tests, we've got like big curriculums that are set up that are not suited to every single individual student. I've definitely got some students who I teach English, and I've got some students who are never going to really use a lot of the skills that we're giving them in their future life, but we force them to go through it anyway. They don't care, they don't want to be there, but they have to be. And, you know, it's not nice. It's quite disheartening to a lot of students to be going through an education system that does not recognize their individual skills and abilities and where they fall short and are not able to catch up effectively. It's interesting. I don't know where I'm going.
A lot of extrapolation from a show that doesn't... I mean, certainly, I've already said it's not giving you as much information on this stuff as the light novels, but...
Yeah. Do the light novels expand on that in any way, from what you've read?
Yeah, a bit. I would have to read more to talk more about it.
Right. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
Sorry. We'll come back on Unabara, Railgun, all this fake dating stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, they're hanging out, and while Unabara is talking to Toma. He looks across and sees Unabara walk into the shop that Misaka just walked into. And he goes, do you have a brother? I saw someone who not just looks like you, but looked exactly like you running into that shop. And Unabara immediately gives up the ghost and goes, oh, well, you weren't most supposed to see that, and starts shooting him with an obsidian dagger that shoots lasers.
The spear of Tuahui's Calpante Culichi.
Beautiful. No notes. I don't know anything about South American Aztec pronunciation.
If my indigenous Mexican is off, you can email endless08@yahoo.com and let me know.
Oh, beautiful. I've got a note here that just says, Unabara is an awful shot. Toma was standing about not even 2 meters away from him and he fucking missed.
There's real stormtrooper shit happening. Yeah.
So it turns out the other Unabara who ran after Misaka was the real one, and he was like, please run away, like something's up. And so Toma ends up calling Index on the phone, who Index is watching a magical girl show.
Yeah.
And is taking all of this magical girl lore as fact and very seriously. Very cute. I really like it a lot. And then she explains that if there's somebody who's got somebody else's face, then it sounds like it's probably Aztec magic. And there was some old Aztec magic where somebody would flay someone and wear their skin. And yeah. It's just like, hang on a minute, what? Is that really where we're going with this?
Yes. And when we have seen Unabara show up, he's got this bandaged arm. So yeah. We can infer from that all of the skin has like been peeled off of his arm for this ritual.
Amazing. Amazing. And the dagger thing that he's got is...
which reflects the light of Venus, or the Aztec god of Venus.
Yeah, crazy. And it turns out that Unabara is actually chasing Toma. He's actually here for Toma, because...
this got very convoluted.
Yeah.
They have a fight scene in a construction yard. He stops the light-reflecting dagger by using a shovel to throw gravel everywhere. And then beams start falling off of the construction site for reasons I couldn't fully discern.
No.
But they've all got to dodge the beams.
Yep. So it's during this fight. Again, I just need to say again, the fight scenes in this show, not the best, because we've got so much of the, like, fighting for 10 seconds and stop and then talk and then fight for a couple more seconds and stop and talk and... at least this time they weren't explaining what their moves were, but, you know, it was really quite exposition heavy.
None of them have interesting enough moves for that to be something that works.
Yeah. So instead they replace that with our exposition. And so among the magical cabal, sects, religions, whatever you would call it, they have dubbed Kamijo and his friends the Kamijo Forces, which is the dumbest name I've ever heard in my life. And... they're all basically just trying to take out him or his people because they are a threat to the balance between magical society and science and atheistic society. Why he was spelling all this out instead of just killing the dude? I don't know, but he did.
But then, yeah, at the end, he's like, oh, by the way, I did actually have a crush on Misaka because while I was spending a week stalking her to try and draw you out to fight you, with my Aztec powers, I did really fall in love with her. So you have to empathize with me now.
What the fuck, dude? No. You're just an asshole. Oh, yeah.
You have no rapport with this girl.
There was a moment at the very end of the fight when, like, there's a final beam falling and Kamijo's like, oh my God. He gets up and runs. He's like, watch out. And the beams all start to fall. Just before we cut away and then cut back to see, like, you know, Unabara is on the floor, like, crushed by a beam, whatever, he's kind of, I think he's dying. Yeah. I'm not actually sure, but it looks like he's dying. We see a sparkle of electricity on the beam that is falling. Is that, like, did Railgun see this happening and, like, shoot away the beam?
Yeah, she's hiding there at the very end. She saw Toma go to, like, dive and save this guy. And was like, Toma's going to get crushed to death if he does this. And she was the one who uses her powers to flip that.
Right,
but okay. She keeps it secret. She never tells Toma about it.
I inferred that was the case. But the way it was shot just made it look like there was a bit of electricity. And then Unabara's dead. And I'm like there is no very clear shot of the beam moving or anything like that. Not
he
dead.
He laid on the ground and bitched for a bit.
He was crushed. But like, I didn't immediately get the fact that... she had saved Toma specifically. It just looked kind of like She just tried to shoot the beam away, and then a bunch of beams fell on everyone anyway.
Yeah, and look, the fundamental problem here is, it's never explained why the beams are falling in the first place. They are not fighting each other destructively enough that it would be shaking the building for any reason.
No, I think the only thing we could say is that the laser beams that were shot out of the spear were meant to have, like, cut through some of the beams, and then eventually that led to some falling on top of the others. But it wouldn't have been, you know, as we had in the thing, slow, like, oh my god, there's a beam. Oh my god, there's another beam.
Yeah.
It would have been one immediately hitting another and then bringing three down together with it, then bringing four more on top of it. Like, it wouldn't have been one at a time, nice and pretty. Mm. Overall, single episode arc that was just for exposition more than anything else.
It sure was.
We did get some...
There was some nice Railgun character.
There was some nice Railgun. There was some nice Shidai. Honestly, my favorite character at this point is Shidai Kuroko. I love her so much. She's just such an asshole. And she's got the coolest power. Oh my god, she can teleport shit. It's so cool.
Yeah, definitely in terms of people doing the most, like, community good with their powers, she's up there. Because it later gets into the fact that, you know, she works with Judgment, which is like the volunteer... group that, you know, helps. They're like
volunteer law enforcement, emergency evacuation.
Yeah, they're
stuff.
More like an SES type team.
We say that, but there's actually in the Railgun spinoff, I know for a fact that there are moments when they actually have to apprehend criminals.
They have
and stuff.
Arrest powers.
They do. You'll notice that one of her powers that she, like, one of the things you can do with the power is that she, like, on her leg, right up on her thigh, she's got a band of, like, sharp, not needles, they're not that thin, but like sharp metal poles.
Yeah, she uses them against Cromwell, yeah.
And she uses those, she teleports them, like she knocks, like basically somebody's on the ground, and teleports them into their clothes and the ground so that they're pinned to the ground. That's how she arrests people. They have powers to do that. They're giving this power to a 13-year-old?
13-year-old, yeah.
Wow. Okay, what a weird city. Yeah.
Cool. Moving on from that, we go back to Accelerator for a bit.
Accelerator's
fun,
back.
Fun, bold move to move away from Toma for like two whole episodes.
Yeah.
And to have him in the introduction bitching about how he's not in the episodes.
Very fun.
But we will need to do a correction from last time because...
I was wrong last time. I said that Toma's amazing punches fucked him up so much that Accelerator couldn't use his powers anymore. I was wrong. I forgot about this arc here. He actually got shot in the fucking face, yes. And that's what ruined his powers.
That'll do it.
So in this one, Accelerator's hanging out. Because he's now been kind of knocked off of the top, like number one, like level 5 Esper in the city, there's just a bunch of fucking punks coming around trying to fight him all the time. He's dealing with them, no problem. They basically just come up, try and hit him, and he just reflects them away. No big deal. And as he's doing this, one night after he goes and gets some food, a small child, like, starts running up behind him and starts jabbering at him, but he's not listening. He's got his, like, noise-canceling vector redirection turned on. He's got noise-canceling headphones.
It's really, no, Accelerator, your AirPods.
So he's got his reflection on, and then he turns it off, and then this young girl starts, you know, oh my god, you're listening to me now, fantastic. Turns out it's one of the Misaka clones, but... it's like a child Misaka clone. Like, I'm assuming like 8, 9 maybe. Like, looks very young.
In that ballpark.
She's
walks
naked.
Walks around naked and...
She's naked, wearing a blanket, and Accelerator just rips the blanket off. And then we have a lingering shot on a naked, like, 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. Again, just don't need this.
Yeah, that one... that shot was definitely like less fan service-y. Than the index ones, like
for sure,
it wasn't that kind of shot, but it was still more nudity than I would have liked to see.
Honestly, like having the shot in there is not the problem; it's the fact that we linger on it for more than a second.
Mm.
If it had just been quick shot, oh my god, like that, shocking! She's actually naked. Wow, but it wasn't. It was shock. She's naked. Keep looking. It's a shock, isn't it? Okay, we can move on. Like,
give her some pants. Like, what purpose does it actually serve the story that she doesn't have any clothes in her?
Even worse, it took me out of it because Accelerator doesn't get her any clothes. We know this about Accelerator. He's an asshole. He wouldn't be doing that. He lets her hang around with him, but he's not going
to
get her some clothes.
They go to the Denny's the next day, and she's still just there in her blanket.
They go to the family restaurant, and nobody is pointing out, hang on a minute. Like, even if they don't know that she's naked, Why is there a girl running around with a tattered, shitty blanket wrapped around her? Something's clearly up here. Better yet, he leaves her there. And nobody at the restaurant fucking questions.
No, it continues to not question it when another random dude comes and takes her.
When another old dude wearing a lab coat comes and takes her away.
Like, oh, I guess, no, that could have been her uncle, I guess.
I guess, yeah, because, you know, Accelerator and whoever the scientist dude are looked completely alike. We do find out some fantastic lore here that the young Misaka girl asks why his hair is white. And he explains, like, I don't know, something about the fact that, like, you know, like, you have pigment in your hair and on your skin because, you know, it's needed to block UV rays or whatever, but I just block all of them automatically anyway, so I guess my body doesn't need it. And so I have a note that just says, so the reason that he's white and has white hair is because he's strong. That's a very interesting message. He's not white.
Yeah, he's definitely a vitamin D deficiency going on there.
I shouldn't say he's white. He's. I'm fairly certain he's meant to still be of Asian complexion, but he's just got very pale skin.
He's very pasty, yeah.
But yeah, that's a weird one. That's a weird way to put it. Okay.
He goes to visit a lady in a laboratory, and we have this complex thing that unfolds where they explain, oh, this Misaka mini version is actually number 20,001 of the 20,000 clones. And the reason this one's significant is that she's the control tower for all of the others. She's not intended for fighting. She's just intended to be a beacon and help them all coordinate their thoughts into a single hive mind.
Yeah, really cool. I like this idea. It's really interesting. They mentioned like why they kept her young instead of letting her age up to the other, in line with the other ones. That didn't need to happen. Like, whatever, I guess. I'm not going to complain, really, because I think she's a cute little character. It's nice and fun.
She's visually different, yeah.
Yeah. But it turns out that she is not working properly. When they're hanging out in the restaurant for a moment, she flops face down and is like, I got pulled out of the tank and, like, I still, you know, I'm not up with it yet. I just need a bit more food. It's fine. That's when Accelerator goes and chats to the person, and the person says, oh, no. Somebody uploaded a virus to the Misaka network.
Yeah, and it's going to turn them all into Terminators that murder everyone.
It's going to turn them all into killer clones. Oh, what a cool idea. Fantastic.
That's fun. We are in like classic sci-fi territory here.
Yeah, so good. So good. And so Accelerator is then given the task. You can either go back and find the girl or go and find the scientist dude who's an asshole and go kill him. And the lady says, I know what you're going to pick. You're only good at killing. And he goes, yeah, you're right. And then takes the one to go and save the little sister, which is fantastic. I love it. Turns out she's been taken by the scientist. So he's going to get to kill the guy anyway.
Yes.
Win-win. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think we probably could have figured that out. Like, he could have figured that out pretty easily that, like, you know what? This guy probably knows where she is and he's probably looking for her.
So last time we were talking about his powers, the vector power, discussing the parameters of what it actually means to control vectors.
Yep.
In this episode, we decide that being able to control vectors means that he can, before we were talking about him moving blood around in the body in a different direction to change their bioelectricity and biochemistry.
Yep.
Turns out he can do this to such a high level of degree that he can control the neurons in Misaka's brain.
He can, like, rewrite Misaka's brain. Computer. What? And my favorite bit is that, so there's a big moment. He finds the scientist and the scientist shoots him, but he reflects the bullet, whatever. And scientist is on the ground somewhere. And he decides, oh my God, I need to deal with this. The virus is about to activate. Gets the scientist lady on the phone and says, hey, what can we do? And she says, I'm on my way to you. You just got to sit tight. Because we've got to, you know, deal with the thing. And then suddenly it turns out that, oh, we don't have an hour before this goes off. We've got about 5 minutes. And so Accelerator goes into overdrive and goes, all right, fuck you, scientist lady. I'm going to try this thing. Throws the phone away, picks up the little iPad, looks at all of Mini Misaka's original brain programming.
Yeah, he just skims through pages and pages of coding.
And just memorizes it.
It's like, not only have I memorized that, I can turn that into bioelectricity and turn that into neurons inside of the brain.
Amazing. It's unbelievable.
This is too far outside of the spectrum of what we've established this man can do.
And I was really torn in this, like, little arc because, last time I'd noted that, like, you know, in the thing they mentioned that he's doing calculations. He's like, he needs to know which way the wind is blowing and things like that. But then we get a flashback in this to him when he was a kid, like a kid, and he's just reflecting shit all over the place. There's like secret agents with guns all up coming up and trying to shoot him, and he's just like standing there.
Kill this kid with a tank for unclear reasons.
And you know, like, in my mind, that kind of flies in the face that he needs to, you know, do calculations, because clearly, as a kid, he was not doing calculations, surely. Like, yeah, that wasn't happening.
It's an intuitive thing, absolutely.
But then when we get further into this, clearly he's doing some kind of, like, he mentions doing some kind of calculation-y stuff in order to rewire Mini Misaka's brain. So he's got to be doing some of it. So maybe the powers just aren't as reliant on, you know, calculations and actually knowing that kind of stuff as much as it is just feeling it and vibing with it. But, you know, it just makes it murky. And, you know, I liked the interesting element of the needing to be smart in order to do this stuff, and we kind of lose it and then get it back. I don't know, it's a bit wishy-washy.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crapshoot with how this is handled. Especially since the whole point with, like, the Espers and the other mages is to have clearly defined powers and to have clearly defined weak points,
yeah,
that come up in this.
Yeah. So as he's rewiring Mini Misaka's brain, scientist is still alive, pulls out a second gun, because he's just got a second gun, and shoots Accelerator in the fucking face. Beautiful stuff. Accelerator's got this moment where time slows down, and he goes, okay, if I, you know, like, pull my hands away and stop doing the thing, then I can reflect it, but then, I can't re-continue doing the programming, because then the virus will just explode back out again. So he finishes the programming, and as he pulls away, pulls up his barrier, just as the bullet is entering his brain, and so he lives.
Yes, he's deflected it just as it's entered the front of his brain and shoots it back out again.
Yeah.
Which is how you get a lot of blood in your fucking brain.
Yeah. Yeah. And so scientist guy thinks that he's won. He's like, ah, ha, 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 I've got the little girl still. I can do something, whatever. And then scientist lady shows up and shoots him.
Yes. There is quite a bit of a drawn out scene between these two.
Very much.
Where she gives a monologue about her personal virtues and the value of nurturing young lives.
And he monologues back at her. Honestly, both of these characters were introduced in this thing, and I don't really care about either of them. Honestly, this lady, like, we're meant to be recognizing that, like, yeah, she's a cool lady, whatever. She was one of the big people behind this whole murdering 20,000 sisters thing. So you know what?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not on your side, hun. I don't care if you're having, like, all redemption arc, trying to bring it back. No.
So what is your understanding as to why this guy was infecting the Misaka network
because
to turn them into killers?
Like, from what they told us, he was being paid by somebody to start some kind of conflict. It was not clear in any way, but it was that he had no money and somebody was paying him to run this job.
Yes. He was resentful and mad that the entire project got shut down, so was willing to sabotage the whole thing. But there is an implication that someone else behind the scenes...
But I don't think we're meant to know who that is. I think it was just, like, people with money somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, we would find out that it was actually Academy City Board themselves. That feels a bit too, out of place.
Yeah, but we're definitely building something up with Alistair, the guy who hangs upside down in the tank.
For sure. But I don't feel like he had anything to do with this, because we didn't have any scenes that involved him talking about Misaka Network or anything.
Yeah.
Like, every other time that he seems to have been involved with something, we see a scene of him and Stale talking about something, or him and Jimmy Cardo's talking about, like, the thing. Whereas this time we didn't get that. It was just, I'm assuming this is just some, like, Yakuza group somewhere, maybe, something like that. Yeah, the scientist lady shoots the bad guy. Bad guy shoots the scientist lady as well. Scientist lady wakes up in the hospital with Frog Doctor. And she was like, what the fuck? I got shot in the fucking heart. I should be dead. Turns out, according to Frog Doctor,
like, actually, you got shot in the aorta.
What a good dude. turns out that even though he was unconscious, Accelerator still somehow had part of his powers running, and so he was, for a full, like, however long it took for the, like, ambulance to arrive and get him to the doctor, to the hospital and stuff, he was effectively moving the blood through the hole in her heart, Cool stuff. Great. Awesome. Then we also find out that because he's been shot in the brain, his calculation part of his brain no longer works properly.
Yeah, so the linguistic and calculative parts of the brain.
However, Frog Docker, smart as he is, has decided to somehow, scientifically, supplement those functions of his brain with the Misaka network. I love this. I think this is a really cool idea. The idea that just earlier in the season, his whole Accelerator's whole thing was that his goal was kill all the Misaka sisters, basically wipe out this network.
Yeah.
But now the plan's failed. You know, his life has changed, and all of a sudden he is relying on this network to live. I just think that's beautiful. It's like a really nice turnaround. Fantastic writing. Well done.
It's an interesting dynamic to set up, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, Mini Misaka is alive. She's hanging out. We don't actually see any of her, but she's there. Cool.
Yeah.
Chilling out. Fantastic. She does show up later on in other seasons. She's probably one of my favorite characters. Just little kid running around being a little kid.
Yeah. You probably should go watch the Accelerator spinoff then, because I understand that is just an entire show of the adventures of those two.
Okay, I guess I'm going to have to do that. I never actually watched it, but yeah. Because I don't think as a kid when I watched it, I didn't like Accelerator very much. Mm. Obviously, he's a bad guy, but, you know, I didn't find him appealing. Whereas, I don't know, this time I'm watching it and I'm like, yeah, he's an asshole for sure.
Yes.
But I went back and I listened to our Toradora episodes, particularly the first one when I was complaining that everyone was an asshole and it was really annoying and I couldn't get in with it. I like it in this one because it's just the one asshole. And I can be like, I know he's meant to be an asshole. Great. That's what he's there for. Fantastic. And I'm really vibing with it.
We finished this here with a fairly long arc that is set up around a mage, Sherry Cromwell.
Yeah. She is a member of the Puritan Church.
She's from Necessarius, which is Index's sect.
Yeah, and she rocks up in Academy City and is just a terrorist. She wants to start some shit.
Yes.
We find out eventually that the reason she wants to start the shit is because this is some of the worst reasoning, honestly. Like, listening through it, I was like, this just doesn't make any sense. There have been times before when the church and the scientific side have tried to, you know, work together and kind of have some kind of teamwork happening. And one of those previous times, her boyfriend, I think, a friend of hers, was like the person who came in to do it. And he died horribly because obviously as we found out with Shimikado, if you're a magic user, if you're an SP user that you use magic, it like ruins your body. Presumably it's the same way with the other one. And in this case, it ended up killing him. And so she's here as revenge, but also just to start another kind of war between the two sides. So that, they will not ever try, you know, working together again, but she also doesn't want to for some reason.
Oh, yeah, she wants to be stopped.
She wants to be stopped.
She wants Toma to defeat her.
But no, just no, not at all.
Yeah, look, I didn't love her as a sort of big bad with what's supposed to be a strong ending to season one, and it's not a strong ending.
No, not really. I
think if I can continue, I think the golem is maybe one of the most undercooked things that's happening here with magic as well.
Absolutely. We don't really get any explanation of it at all. We do as it's happening, but not set up and not any payoff for any of the, like, any of its powers or anything. Like, it's just kind of a big monster that...
Yeah. This one felt like it should have been easy to research. People know what golems are.
Exactly. And we do find out that, the golem is called...
She's named it Golem Ellis.
So she's named
Ellis was her friend who was the Esper who died after having magic experiments done to him.
Yeah, so we've got I don't know, I guess some kind of connection there. But
is your understanding that he is actually connected to this beast in another way, or she is just named her rock monster after him?
My understanding was that Ellis's soul was what was powering that golem.
I don't think it's super clear on that.
No, it's not. And that's not the way golems work.
Yeah, that's
work.
Not what a golem is.
No, for those who aren't aware, like, the general story of the golem is that it's a person made out of clay, and that you write like some specific stuff on paper and put it into their mouths, and that paper is what gives them their
not their soul. It's like a Jewish folklore thing.
Yeah, it's what animates them, and so like they wouldn't have a human soul in them.
Yeah, I think we miss a lot of what actually makes a golem here. Like you said, there is that you know, the control paper, or like even a control gem or something.
Yeah,
would be good. The guardian element. Yes. Golems are created to be guardians. And generally, the reason it becomes a problem is they turn out to be much more violent than the creator expected, and they have to be forcibly shut down in some way. A lot of iterations of the golem in other media don't hit all of these beats, but they at least hit one beat.
Yes.
This hits zero.
Yeah.
And at that point, that's just a rock monster.
Yeah.
This is just a rock elemental.
Rock monster.
It's just annoying after this guy is, you know, pulling out Aztec fucking mythology on us. And they can't do basic research on this shit. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely, definitely disappointing. We do get a bit of nice development between our main cast of characters. We end up, Misaka and Index end up meeting for the first time, and both instantly dislike each other, and then both instantly dislike Toma because they want to... Misaka goes, "How do you know him?" And Index goes, "Oh, well, he saved my life." And then Misaka goes, "Oh, you too?" And they both go, "What the fuck are you doing, Toma? What's going on here?" Great moment. I like that. I have a note here that just says, "I forgot just how tsundere-coded Index was." It was happening in the first half, but I really noticed in this one that every second scene she's in, Toma will say something and she'll go, "Oh, it's not because I like doing that thing," or something like that. And I'm like, "Oh, really? Again? Doing this again? I forgot this was so much of your character. It's just kind of disappointing, I guess, and generic."
Yeah, after having been shelved for a while, and then when they do bring her back and try and tie her back into the story, they don't do a lot with her.
Not really, no.
And they're trying to introduce this other new character as well, because they have a scene where he goes to the high school, and they announce that there's going to be a transfer student, and then Index walks in. And the teacher goes, "No, you're not the fucking transfer student," and pushes her out. And it's actually Aisa Himegami, the deep blood.
Yes.
Before, which I think that is, they could have explained a bit more about that, because they just kind of bring it in as the joke and then don't really address like why she's there or anything. Mm-hmm. She's also a sorcerer, right? She doesn't cast spells, but she has an innate magical ability, which is deep blood.
She does, but I don't know if that makes her a sorcerer or not. Because the fact that she's now been transferred to this school, especially if we're taking the presupposition that the school is for the development of Esper powers,
yeah,
that means that they're going to be trying to give her Esper powers.
Yeah, that could really mess her up. I feel like we need to touch on that.
But will it, though? Because again, we haven't seen her use magic. As far as we know, she doesn't use magic, but she has this ability. Is this ability inherently a magical ability, or is it just some other kind of supernatural ability that she's got? Interesting question. Absolutely unaddressed. Never even looks at it briefly.
No, the reason she is in this story at all is because there is another transfer student, Kazekiri.
Yes.
Who there's this glasses girl who starts hanging out and making friends with Index. And as they're like wandering around, Toma agrees to go get lunch with them. And Himegami sees her. And they're like, "Oh, I recognize that name. That is the name that, you know, she used to be in the cram school, and she was mysteriously number one in the cram school, but no one had ever met her." Mm. And she's related to the imaginary number school district of the Five Eyes Institution or something.
How does Himegami know this?
This was the one time in this show where I had to rewind and watch that again, because I just went, "What the fuck are you saying?"
I saw that and I heard them saying it, and I just went, "I'm not going to fucking remember that. I don't care enough. This is not worth my time."
Yeah, she is the key to the imaginary number school district. What does that mean, BJ?
No fucking clue. Absolutely no idea. I don't do math. I know that imaginary number... Is it imaginary numbers? I believe imaginary numbers is a like mathematical term.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means. I know nothing about that. The show doesn't tell us anything about that. What does it mean that it's a district? Are you saying that like there is an area of this city where there is just the imaginary numbers happening?
Well, there is, in a way.
Okay.
So you know, as it comes out, you know, they get trapped in this underground subway because Cromwell has shown up with the so-called Golem Atlas and is just destroying shit. And there's like SWAT teams down there. There's a SWAT team fight. This Kazekiri gets punched by the Golem and part of her face breaks off and there's like a glowing prism inside her. And then it like reconstitutes her face. And Toma like calls the teacher and he's like, hey, this fucking weird thing happened. And she goes, oh, well, theoretically she could be made as the overlap of all of the AIM diffusion fields that all of the Espers have been putting out to create a fiction of a person. And he goes, yeah, okay, sounds good.
Yeah, I really feel like the first time we hear about the AIM diffusion fields is at the beginning of this arc. And it's not like, I really appreciated in the first arc, in the first half of this, we had those things where this thing would happen and that would cause this thing to happen and that would cause this thing to happen and that would cause this thing to happen. That is not happening in the second half. They just dropped it. And
the wheels are rolling away from the vehicle.
Really disappointed with that. And this feels like one of those things where we could have had something where we could have, in a previous one, introduced the idea that, oh yeah, like the teacher is just reading a book about AIM diffusion fields or something. And she mentions it briefly, like, oh yeah, this is a weird thing that happens. We're like, oh, okay, just a bit of lore. Interesting. And then we bring it up again later. And then she goes, oh my God, this is actually the thing. They just... first episode of the arc, they mention, like, they bring it up as a thing. Second episode of the arc, we go, oh, okay, look, Kazekiri is here, and she is the embodiment of these overlapping AIM fields. And I'm just like, cool idea for sure, but this has come out of nowhere. How has there not been anything previously to this?
Yeah, and so my understanding of this is that the imaginary number school district is where Kazekiri was previously located, her weird sort of reality she existed in before, where everyone was constantly shifting into different people and she couldn't interact with anything. And when she touched Index, for whatever reason, that pulled her out of the imaginary number school district and into one of the real numbered school districts.
Right, okay. So is that imaginary school number district, is it just a different dimension, reality? Is it a reality overlaid on top of our own?
It's a potential heaven, as Sushi Mikado says at the end. It's like, I see what you're doing, Alistair. You're putting a ton of Espers in the same place and increasing their power because that is building this imaginary number school district, which is then going to become a more real and real place. And he says, I think Kazekiri is an angel.
Yeah,
angel of this place.
The specific explanation he made was that an angel was something that was an angel is something that is made in the image of man by God, and Kazekiri herself was made by men, but she was made effectively in the image of man. She is the overlapping AIM fields are like all of the, I don't know, I guess the ideas of an Esper and being an Esper, like to be an Esper, you have to be a human. And so therefore it is made in the image of a man. Bit of a stretch, but okay. Like it's interesting, I guess.
Why do you think the show comes around on this idea so often? Because Kazekiri is their second time dipping into this with the Misaka network being the first time where we are discussing the humanity of the clones and how much value their lives actually have. Because, you know, Toma believes that they have value, but there are lots of people in the city, and even they themselves don't actually think they have value because they don't consider themselves to be real people.
Mm-hmm.
And Kazekiri goes through this as well, where because she doesn't consider herself to be a real person, she starts doing self-destructive things.
Yep. I really am not entirely sure why they keep coming around on this idea. I think that it was an interesting thing to talk about with the clones. And it was like nicely explored, I think. I really felt that here it just felt not tacked on, but somewhat artificial character, like not development, character motivation. Like she realizes that she is not a human when she cracks her head open and the thing was there and she sees it. And then kind of just immediately takes a snap of, oh, well, if I'm not human, then I'm a monster, and that means that I've got to go and fight the monster. And I just, like, that, it felt like a logical leap that just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Especially given the short amount of time we've got, given a couple more episodes of thinking about these things, sure, I could see that happening, but not the space of 2 minutes in an episode. Like, that just felt melodramatic and just artificial. But yeah, I don't know why we're coming back to this one again, to be honest. I guess you could, like, if we've got the kind of sinister background motivation of Alistair, of trying to create a heaven, then I guess we will be and end up in a discussion of, you know, what is the value of a human compared to an angel? And, like, you know, get into some really religious philosophical ideas and the kind of hierarchy of man. But I don't feel like we're anywhere near that yet.
Yeah, it maybe hasn't done some of the groundwork it needs to before it gets into this theme.
Yeah, yeah. It feels very out of nowhere.
To circle around, you know, this arc is, it ends with Toma, like, having the big fight with Sherry and with the golem. He enlists the SWAT team to help him fight the monster. And a lot of this is just scenes of this SWAT team with machine guns all shooting at the monster. And the monster's not doing anything. It's like, oh no, I'm being hit by bullets, so I can't come forward or anything.
Basically,
I don't understand the choreography choices here, basically.
No, it is really sloppy. The idea is that he uses them as a distraction so that he can get under the golem and take out the caster, which I guess, you know, strategy, I guess that works. But it's, again, it's just like, why is this golem give a crap about the bullets? We've just seen, you know, a couple minutes ago, them shooting the golem and it having no effect whatsoever. It just continued fucking shit up. And somehow this time, when we shoot it with bullets even harder, it stops for a while, I guess.
There's a very dumb moment here where, like, he uses the distraction to sneak between the golem's leg and he punches Cromwell. And then he's about to go touch the leg, but then he, like, Sherry sits up and starts, like, talking to him again. And he gets so distracted by the conversation that he doesn't touch the fucking golem.
It's just... So, like,
come on, man, it's right there. It's right there.
Well, honestly, all you even need to do is just, as she's talking, just lean over a bit against it. Like, that's all you needed to do. Yeah, it's weird. And she runs away, and in running away, she's got to let the golem disappear again for a bit so everything's calm again. There's a big hole in the floor that she's run off through. And turns out that as she does that, she sends the golem off on its own to go and find Index to kill Index, because she doesn't care who she kills. She just needs to kill somebody related to...
Someone of plot relevance.
Somebody of plot relevance, exactly. In order to start a big war between the two main factions. This is the moment when Hyoka decides that, yeah, okay, I'm a monster, so I need to go and fight the golem.
There is some fun stuff here where Index's Librorum Prohibitorum, whatever it is, kicks in, and she starts, like, yelling out all of these, like, override command instructions to make the golem, like, swing its hands around.
Very fun. Honestly, I think the most interesting thing Index has done in the series.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Like, it's, like, this. If this is how she does combat, fantastic, novel. It's very interesting, because obviously she is not a person to fight. She can't cast spells. Because of the fact that she's got the books in her means that she can't cast the spells. There's a block on her or whatever. And she's not physically strong in any way. She's a little kid. But yeah, she starts doing that stuff. She's got all this knowledge. She figures out that there's a weak point in the golem and that it's got, like, a regeneration cycle that happens once every couple of seconds. And if she can somehow get one of the clothespins that is holding her clothing together, she can get that in a certain spot, then it'll stop the regeneration cycle for a bit. Cool, interesting stuff.
Not how it ends up being taken down at all.
Not at all.
It gets taken down because Toma shows up and punches it.
Yeah, as I said, we've got Toma kills the big bad, both of them, with two big punches.
Yeah, he's down with Sherry, and it wants to do this moment where, you know, there's all these magic circles and she's going to cave in the tunnel. But he realizes, because Index was yelling at him earlier in the arc about something about sorcerers and positioning and how you can tell where someone's protective magic circle is going to be because it needs to be at a certain angle away. like diagonally behind you.
It wasn't even specifically that. It was the fact that he I thought this was a nice bit of development for him. He actually like thought things through for a moment, and he realized that if all of the circles are on the wall and there's one on the floor, that one has to be protecting her because the rest of them are just releasing the rocks. And why would you need one on the floor if it's releasing rocks? If it's not releasing rocks, it's clearly doing something different. It's the only one out of place, so that's the one I've got to go touch. Cool stuff. But then he just goes and punches her again.
Yes.
Big punch.
Which, to be fair, she doesn't have much of a thought-out ability to be able to undermine.
No, no.
Like, she's got a piece of chalk and she is writing the word Golem Ellis out a bunch.
Yep.
And that's how you make a Golem Ellis.
Yes. Yes, that's it. In the end, both Index and Toma help Kazekiri get through her.
She's having an existential moment.
That was the word. I couldn't remember the word existential.
They again do the thing that he did with the Misakas, where he says, no, you have worth as a person.
There is someone here who appreciates you as a person. You clearly do have some worth. Interestingly enough, he doesn't say that it's him. He does say that it's Index. Not particularly important, but, you know, interesting.
You have at least one friend in the world. Not me. It's Index.
Yeah, and then that's basically the end of it. She feels better. She does end up disappearing again because the way, like, she doesn't have an actual body. It's, you know, her own creation of a representation, and it doesn't last for very long. So she ends up going back to the imaginary number district. But, you know, she's around. Cool. Great. We'll probably see some more of her in the future. Maybe. Yeah. Probably not. Honestly, I have no idea.
The rest of the tail end is all just seeding different stuff in.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like the moment that after all of the big fighting, he does go back to the frog doctor and he says, look, you don't even need to check me in this time. He's got like a band-aid on his hand and he's like, see, I'm getting better. I'm not hurt. And the girls beat him up because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coming out the tail end of this, like, you know, it didn't end as strong as it started, but do you think, you know, yeah, you've at least enjoyed revisiting this.
Absolutely.
I get that impression.
Absolutely. This has been a real fun time to go back and watch again.
Thank you for listening to Endless 08. I've been Duffo.
And I've been BJ. You can find all our stuff at endless08.com and on our social media.
If you know a real freak, tell them about the show. We'll see you next time.